Thank you. Thanks very much for having me. It's really nice to be back and get a chance to talk with many of you. Today, I want to tell you about some recent and ongoing work to look for signs of beyond the standard model physics in some interesting and out-of-the-way places. So we all currently live in the age of the standard models. We know that our universe is well described by a fixed set of particles, interactions, and parameters that explain very well the world we find ourselves in today. Depending on your point of view, we may be lucky or unlucky to live in such an age where everything is described by the standard models. Of course, we know that the standard models have had great successes on the cosmological side. The cosmic microwave background tells us with exquisite precision all the parameters of lambda CDM. We've also had great discoveries with gravitational waves found in the last 5 years and already telling us a lot about the universe that we live in. The particle physics side, we've also had some great successes. We found the Higgs in the last 10 years, which completes the standard model description of particle physics. And we're continually improving precision measurement, which agrees better and better with theoretical expectations. But of course, we all know that that's not the end of the story. And there's many problems with these standard models that we find ourselves living in. Of course, experimentally, the issues mostly arise from cosmology and astrophysics. We don't know what is the dark matter. Is there a particle that describes what the dark matter is of the universe? That's an experimental question. There's also more theoretical concerns like small numbers that we find in the description of the standard model that we can't explain with the current data. So there's a lot more to do, and there's been a lot of concerted effort to look around the energy scales of the standard model. So we have currently a set of particles that mostly fall within a few orders of magnitude in mass. And these are well understood, and we've been pushing very successfully, well, not we, but the experimentalists have been pushing very successfully the knowledge to higher energy scales with the Collider program, and also to lower energy scales with the dark matter program. But what I want to focus on today is a very different part of the parameter space. We know that there's other scales that must enter in a fundamental theory to address these questions that I alluded to. And today I want to focus on the lighter end of the mass range, which is motivated by several points. One is the theoretical problem, which is known as the strong CP problem, that motivates the existence of a particle known as the QCD axion. It also turns out that it addresses the experimental problem of the dark matter. So the QCD axion could also be the dark matter of the universe. And the important point is that these particles, the QCD axion and its cousins, are typically very light and very weakly interacting, so they require new theoretical ideas to test these models. So that's what I'll be focusing on today. First, I'll give a bit more details about the motivations of these very light bosons beyond the standard model to get everyone on the same page. And then I'll talk about two directions that I'm pursuing right now. One is trying to think of new ideas to look for these particles in the laboratory. And the other is looking for these particles in the sky around black holes. And I know that often this audience likes to ask questions, so please ask questions throughout so that we're all on the same page. I'm happy to answer them. So going back to the strong CP problem, the statement is that in the standard model, you expect order one CP violation in the strong sector, in the QCD sector, given that we see CP violation already in the weak sector. And if there was such a violation of the charge parity symmetry, then you would expect the neutron to have an electric dipole moment. Even though the neutron is neutral, you'd expect it to have some overall dipole moment. And you can see why this dipole moment violates, for example, the parity symmetry. Parity flips the direction of the dipole moment because it's a vector, but it would, for example, preserve the direction of the spin of the neutron because it's a cross product roughly of the R and the momentum. So that means that if a dipole moment existed, it would have to be both parallel and anti-parallel to the spin of the neutron in order to preserve parity. So the presence of a dipole moment would show us that it's not preserved. And in fact, we have experiments that try to measure the size of this dipole moment, and so far, they're just upper bounds. And the upper bounds are so severe that it's results in a tuning of 1 part in 10 to the 10th. So there's this parameter theta in the standard model that has to combine with existing CP violation in the quark sector to better than 1 in 10 to the 10th precision. And this is what's called the strong CP problem. So this theta parameter that's in front of the gluon CP violating field strength can be resolved by promoting it to a dynamical field, which is called the QCD axion that people have been looking for the last 40 or more years. And it's a very elegant solution. You promote this theta parameter to a dynamical field. And since it's now dynamical, it can relax to the minimum of its potential, naturally setting this parameter close to 0. And this potential, which gives the mass and the self-interactions to the axion, results from non-perturbative QCD effects. The other very motivating point for the axion is that it's a natural dark matter candidate as well as solving the strong CP problem. So soon after the axion was proposed, it was realized that it can be produced as cold dark matter in the early universe. It's a bit of a different production mechanism than what we often think of in, for example, WIMP dark matter. Basically, the axion is you can think of the zero mode of the axion as being governed by a damped harmonic oscillator equation. Basically, like everything in physics, it's a damped harmonic oscillator. And we have the damping is given by a Hubble friction. The oscillations are the frequency of the mass of the particle. And early on, the Hubble friction is large, so the field starts at some initial value in its potential and doesn't move because it's overdamped. But as the universe expands and Hubble drops, the friction reduces and the axion field starts oscillating about its minimum value. And this redshifting with time is exactly the same redshifting as you would expect from cold dark matter. The energy density goes down as 1 over scale factor cubed. And so you can predict the amount of cold dark matter for an axion or axion-like field, just assuming an initial condition during the period of inflation. So what I want you to take away from this is that axions are a very motivated set of particles. The QCD axion is a solution to this theoretical puzzle, the strong CP problem. And they are also very light and very weakly interacting. The mass is set by or basically everything about the QCD axion is set by this parameter FA. So the mass is inversely proportional to this high scale, and its interactions will be determined by this high scale FA. In addition, there are also low energy remnants of physics at high scales, for example, in string theories or theories of extra dimensions. If there's fields propagating in the extra dimensions, axions correspond to zero modes of those fields. And are often found in many of these models where you try to UV complete the standard model. They're also, as I mentioned, great candidates for the dark matter of the universe. And so these last two points are interesting enough on their own to make us look for not just the QCD axion, but also axion-like particles and what are called dark photons, which are basically spin one versions of the axions, which broadens the parameter space that can be interesting in terms of dark matter or these signals of high scale physics. So this is the parameter space that I'll be focusing on today. Here's the mass of the axion and the x-axis.
Sorry,
yes, please.
Is there a similar motivation for these dark photons in terms of like naturalness?
Yeah, so there are similar motivations for dark photons in that they can also arise from these higher dimensional theories. and there also can be the dark matter. There's a slightly different production mechanism for the dark photons, which limits their, so for the axions, as you can see here, for axion-like particles, that can be dark matter at any mass given some coupling. This is for an initial misalignment angle of order one. For dark photons, they're produced through an analog of isotope curvature fluctuations in the early universe, and those are set by the Hubble scale. So they can only be the dark matter if they're heavier than about 10 to the minus 5 EV for that mechanism, but given the current constraints on the Hubble scale. Yeah. Good, thank you. So this is, yeah, so here is the parameter space of axions, and you can see that there's already interesting constraints in this parameter space, but we're nowhere near calling it a victory or a disaster. And so I think an important goal for the next decade or two is to really answer this question: is the QCD axion the dark matter? Is it, does it solve the strong CP problem, or do we need to be looking elsewhere? And so in this part of the talk, I'll talk about some ideas that I proposed to look for axion dark matter at, and dark photon dark matter at these high mass scales, relatively high for this type of particle. So just to get you situated, if you have an axion background or a dark photon background, and you solve Maxwell's equations with these extra new fields, what you find is that basically they act as a background current. So if you have an axion dark matter candidate, it can convert to photons in a background magnetic field. And basically, you can describe it as a background current that's proportional to axion amplitude and the background magnetic field amplitude. Similarly, for dark photons, that's actually even simpler. If you have a dark photon with some mass, it can convert to one of our standard model photons through what's called a kinetic mixing. And these, this is proportional to some small coupling kappa here. And you can also describe it as a background current that's oscillating at the mass of the particle and is just everywhere in space because it's set by the dark matter density. Here I'll be talking about particles that are about EV in mass, which corresponds to wavelengths of a micron for the Compton wavelength or for the photon wavelength. And for the dark matter is non-relativistic in our galaxy with velocity of about 10 to the minus 3, so it's corresponding to Broglie wavelength is longer, it's about a millimeter. So that's what you should have in mind when I talk about these length scales. And the natural question is, there are these couplings to photons that are expected for these types of particles. Can we literally just see this dark matter in photons? If all of dark matter was currently converting to photons today, we'd see a flux that's about a dim light bulb at a meter. So the whole dark matter halo would be glowing in these photons. Of course, that's not what we see, so we know that's not happening. But the reason is not just that these particles are weakly coupled, it's just the basic fact that they're non-relativistic in our galaxy, so they can't conserve both energy and momentum and convert to a relativistic photon that then we would see. So how do we overcome this issue? Can we really look for the dark matter directly through this interaction with photons? So going back to this point that the dark matter, let's say for concreteness, dark photon dark matter acts as a background current. We all know if you have an oscillating current, that source is electromagnetic radiation, right? However, let's talk about this radiation. So if we have photons, their energy would be set by the frequency of oscillation of this current, which is set by the dark matter mass. And so we can get photons that match. If you sit at one point in space, you can emit photons at the right frequency to match the oscillation of this background dark matter current oscillation. However, unlike this current here, which is oscillating up and down in one place, the dark matter, the leading order is constant in space because it's very non-relativistic. So that means that the electric field that's sourced from one place from this point of the dark matter, so here I'm showing the dark matter amplitude as a function of x in orange and the electric field modes in blue. So the electric field that's sourced from this piece of the dark matter is exactly going to be canceled by an electric field that's sourced by the neighboring volume of dark matter, because it's a constant, it's spatially constant throughout. Another way of saying this is just what I said before: you can't conserve both energy and momentum in converting from this non-relativistic background oscillation into relativistic electromagnetic fields. Now, there's a we can't do much to the dark matter itself. By definition, it's weakly coupled, so there's no way we can manipulate it effectively. But we're very good at manipulating light. So what we can do is we can change how the photons behave to make the dark matter radiate into those photons. So we can construct the system here. So I'm showing the amplitude, again, the function of space, for the same frequencies. But now I've put in some periodic dielectric material here, where basically the where you have a large index of refraction in gray, you have a reduced electric field response, because you have all these atoms that are oscillating and reducing the total amount of electric field there. And so now the electric field that's sourced in the white regions, the regions where you have low index of refraction, are no longer canceled by the electric fields that are sourced in the gray regions, just because there's a larger amplitude here. And so now you can get a non-zero electric field that's sourced by these background dark photon fields. If you're coming from a more condensed matter perspective, one way to look at this is that we're changing the dispersion relation of the photon. So here I'm showing the energy as a function of momentum for the photon, again, in blue, and for dark matter in orange. So dark matter is, has a mass and is non-relativistic, so it's sitting right here in the galaxy. For photons, there's the regular linear dispersion where the frequency is proportional to the momentum. So in free space, these lines would never cross. But now that we've constructed this kind of dielectric crystal, there are photon modes which live right here. Basically, that they have energy but don't have any momentum. They're just standing waves. And we can arrange the spacing of these modes exactly such that the energy and momentum of the photon will overlap the energy and momentum of the dark matter. So this is the theorist cartoon of the setup that we proposed, also with Junwoo Hwang, who will be here in a few days, or who is here, I guess. So here we have this dielectric layer setup. As I was saying before, the energy of the electromagnetic radiation that comes out is set by the mass of the dark matter. The dark matter is oscillating at that frequency up to corrections of velocity squared. The outgoing photon momentum is sourced by the periodicity of the lattice, dielectric lattice that we've constructed. So that means that all the photons will go out exactly perpendicular to the layers, because the layers are what's setting the momentum of the photons. And this is very important because that lets you focus the light that's coming out on a very small detector. And the smaller detector, the more sensitive it generally is with current technology. So after we wrote this proposal, we got some experimentalists very excited because this is a very simple setup and it could be done very quickly in the laboratory. So we applied for funding and we got 2 years of funding to build this prototype experiment. It's currently taking place at MIT with support from NIST. And this is what the theorist cartoon looks like in practice. So here we have the dielectric stack, which Jeff Childs, who's a postdoc, just built in a few hours in an afternoon. That's your dark matter detector. This is the lens that you already have on hand. And these are the real workhorse of this experiment, which is very sensitive single photon detector that can see as few as one photon per day. So that's kind of a record that's been demonstrated. So even if your dark matter converts very rarely, you'll be able to see the resulting photon with this very sensitive detector. And all of this together comes in a box about this size. And so you take this experiment, you put it in a box, you put it in a fridge. You stand the theorist next to it. You tell the theorist not to touch the experiment. And then you take data. So right now, we think that this is the limit that we can set, or the reach that we can get with this very small prototype experiment in the dark photon parameter space. So here's the coupling on the y-axis, kappa, which is this mixing between the dark photon and the photon, the mass on the x-axis. The orange curve is the projected sensitivity with the current parameters. And once the fridge is no longer broken, we expect there will be about 2 weeks of runtime to get to these kinds of sensitivities, which are exceeding current bounds by more than an order of magnitude with a very simple setup. In the future, we've also been talking to a range of other groups. We put in a proposal for a larger experimental setup of a wider range of frequencies with Ben Mazin at Santa Barbara. So again, this is the same parameter space. The y-axis is the dark photon coupling, the x-axis is the mass, but you can arrange the spacing of these dielectric layers to cover more efficiently a broad range of dark photon masses. So we're still waiting to hear back on that funding call. What I'm most excited about, though, is that this will also translate into searches for axion dark matter, which is shown on this right-hand plot here. So here's the axion coupling to photons versus mass, and that's our projection for a more aggressive experiment that will use the same technology, but with a background magnetic field and be sensitive to axion dark matter in this mass range. So the message here is that there is a very simple way that you can make dark matter convert very efficiently to photons by helping the photons match the dark matter's inherent dispersion relation. And this experiment is already underway. It's a very quick turnaround time, and I'm very happy that people are interested in actually implementing this in the laboratory. So stay tuned for the results. My dream would be that we find, say, a dark photon that's in this range of parameter space in the optical. So the nice thing about these dielectric layers is the power that you convert from the dark matter to photons, it goes as the square of the number of layers that you deposit. So currently, we're doing these small stacks with 5 layers. But if you build, say, 1,000 layers, the power would go up by a factor of 200 squared. And so that means if you can see where it's a very sensitive detector is 5 layers in the laboratory, with 1,000 layers, you can make dark matter glasses and look for the photons converting directly in from the halo into your eyes. That's if we see a dark photon in the optical range. So that would be very exciting. Any questions on this setup? Yes.
So how do you tune the mass? So it had to do with the separation dielectric. So there's like different separations within that block.
Exactly. Right. So for a given stack that you build, these are just deposited. This is basically similar technology as what you might have on your glasses for like an anti-reflective coating. So you can't tune the stack once you build it. But you want to match the frequency to the mass of the dark. You want to match the periodicity to the mass of the dark matter. And the width to which you're sensitive is given by the inverse number of layers. So right now we have order 10 layers, so the width is about 10%. What you can do is you can deposit the layers with what we call a chirp stack. So basically the layer thickness changes as you build it. And that lets you have, you know, each of these bands here is one separate chirp stack. You can't make them infinitely wide because at that point, the electric field that you source in one part of the stack will start destructively interfering with the electric field that you source from a different part of the stack. So you can do up to 30% with one setup, but they're very small and you can run them in parallel. So right now we're discussing, for example, having an array of sensors and then having different lenses focused, different stacks focused onto each separate sensor, and then you can run many in parallel and cover the whole parameter space. Yeah.
So what is the green line there?
Thank you. Yeah, the green line is what's called the QCD KSVZ axion, which is that the axion couples to photons, but that coupling is model dependent. And so there's different targets for which model you're going for. There's one called KSVZ, which predicts a particular value of the photon coupling as a function of mass. And that's one of the well-motivated benchmark models that people go after. So if we can get below this line, then we're looking for QCD axion coupling to photons. Yeah, thanks. I didn't specify that. Okay. So there's no more questions. We'll move on to the opposite side of the spectrum. I've talked about so far looking at axion and dark photon searches in the EV mass range. But now I want to tell you about how you can look for very long wavelength, very weakly interacting particles with black holes. And this is based on some recent work that I'm doing with a continuous waves group that looks at LIGO data, as well as Robert Lazenby and two really outstanding graduate students that are working with me on this project. I told you about how at an EV, the Compton wavelength particle is about a micron. Now we're moving to the opposite side of the length scales. And I can tell you it's already hard enough to try to build an experiment that looks for a particle that's this size. You can imagine fitting a particle that's a kilometer size in the laboratory and doing your experiment. That's just not going to work. So what? Luckily for us, nature creates its own laboratory experiments for ultralight particles, and those are black holes. And as I'll show you, the interesting point is that astrophysical black holes, like the ones LIGO has seen, have a length scale that's exactly of the size that you need to look for particles that are around 10 to the minus 12 electron volts, which is where the QCD axion has decay constants between the Gut and the Planck scale for QCD axion experts. And the corresponding frequencies of these particles are going to be around a kilohertz. So before I get into the signals that you can get, I want to tell you a quick summary of this process of superradiance, which I know many of you are already familiar with. It's the fact that if you have a rotating object, in particular, in this case, I'll be talking about a black hole, you have an incoming wave, the amplitude of the wave, say a photon or a gravitational wave, will increase if the angular velocity of the black hole is large compared to the angular phase velocity of the wave. And that energy comes as an increase in amplitude, increase in photon or graviton number, and it extracts energy from the black hole rotation. So, and basically, whether the growth happens or not is governed by a superradiance condition, which is comparing the angular velocity of the black hole to the angular velocity of the incoming radiation. Now, this has been known since the 70s when Zeldovich was thinking about the physics of black holes. But later on, people realized that for this one-time scattering process of an incoming gravitational or photon wave can become exponential if the wave has a mass. So basically, what you want to do is you want to trap the particles in the vicinity of the black hole so that this process can repeat continuously instead of having a one-time scattering, which might increase the amplitude by 1% or maybe 5%. And so if you have, for example, a light scalar field with a mass mu, its interaction with the black hole at large distances is just described by Newtonian potential, which is a product of the gravitational constant times the mass of the black hole times the mass of the particle. And so these particles will be trapped in the black hole's vicinity and superradiate continuously. The rates are fastest when the Compton wavelength of the particle is an order of the black hole size, because then the overlap of the particle wave function the black hole horizon is the biggest while still remaining outside of the black hole. So if the particle is too light, then it basically doesn't even see that the black hole is there. If the wavelength is very, very long, if the wavelength is very, very short, then the bound orbits are mostly inside the horizon, and then we don't really care about what happens to it. When the Compton wavelength of the particle is comparable to the size of the black hole, the growth can be very fast on astrophysical timescales. And what do these bound states look like? If you solve the equations of the scalar field far away from the black hole, they look very much just like the equations for a hydrogen atom that you're all familiar with. So you have bound states like the s, p, and d orbitals, and you can describe them by a fine structure constant, which is alpha. Instead of being 1 over 137, as it is for hydrogen, it's the product of the gravitational constant times the mass of the black hole times the mass of the axion, or you can also think of it as the, which is exactly the size of the black hole divided by the Compton wavelength of the particle. And this will be a less than one number, so it's a perturbative calculation. The radius of these clouds are of order of few to a few hundred Schwarzschild radii. And so that most of the cloud is sitting far away from the black hole. And the big difference from hydrogen is that first, these particles are bosons, and second, they have no conserved number, so the black hole can just dump all of its energy and angular momentum into these axions, for example, and you can get as many as 10 to the 75 to 10 to the 80 particles in one state. Now, of course, the other big difference is that there's a black hole at the origin rather than a proton, say, and so the black hole absorbs anything that falls onto the horizon, which is actually what's giving you this super radiance rate. So in contrast to hydrogen, where the energy levels, the energies of, say, the electrons are given by the mass minus some binding energy that's proportional to coupling squared, you also have the same thing here. You have the energies of the axions are given by the mass minus binding energy, but you also have an imaginary component, which comes from this dissipation at the horizon. And that imaginary component can be positive or negative depending on whether the black hole is spinning fast enough. If the superradiance condition is satisfied, the states will grow exponentially with time right when the black hole is born. So let's take that example. Let's say a black hole is born with 40 solar masses and a high spin. Here I'm showing the black hole mass on the x-axis in solar masses and a spin from zero, dimensionless spin from zero to one, where zero is Schwarzschild and one is extremal Kerr. The blue regions are the regions where, for a mass I selected here, just 6 times 10 minus 13 EV, the superradiance condition is satisfied for different angular momentum states, one, two, and three of the axions. So here, black hole is inside the blue region, which means that it rotates quickly enough to superradiate. And within about 1 year, with the parameters I've picked, the black hole will spin down to the superradiance line. And the growth of the level will stop because now the black hole is co-rotating with the phase velocity of the particles. And so the superradiance condition is no longer satisfied. At this point, there are about 10 to the 78 particles in the cloud. The black hole angular momentum has reduced by 10 to the 78 h-bars. Each of the particles carries one h-bar of angular momentum. And that's what sets the limit of the number of particles in the cloud. And of course, you can immediately see that given that the black hole spins down so quickly, you can use the fact that we see rapidly rotating black holes to already place limits on parameter space, which is something that I've worked on. But in the interest of time, I'll just tell you that there are existing bounds, and I'm happy to talk about it later. What I want to focus on today is that this cloud of axions is a source of monochromatic gravitational wave radiation. And this is a signal that can be looked for and is being looked for in LIGO continuous wave searches. Before I get to the gravitational wave, do you have any questions on the basic picture? Good? OK. So what do these signals look like? You have this cloud of particles around the black hole. Just like for the dark matter, the axion amplitude oscillates at the mass of the particle. The energy density of the cloud is quadratic in the axion field, so that means it oscillates at twice the energy of the particle. So you have some energy density which is non-uniform and is oscillating at a given frequency, and that sources gravitational waves. The strain basically is a sine wave, so you have a monochromatic wave that's emitted at about twice the energy of the particle over a very long time, because these signals are quite weak, so they take a long time to deplete the energy of the cloud. if the wavelength of the particle is very large compared to the black hole size, the cloud is fluffy and not very strongly bound. So the signals are fairly weak and they last for a long time. They can last as much as thousands to billions of years. If the cloud is more tightly bound, if the axion wavelength matches the black hole size very well, if they're very close to each other, the axions are relativistic in the cloud, and then the emission from the cloud becomes very strong. You can see it from a large distance, but the length of the signal becomes short, maybe less than a day. So there's different types of searches you want to do for these kinds of signals, and I've proposed both, but today I want to focus on the thing that we can do now, which is the weak and long gravitational wave signals from our galaxy. So what do these signals look like? They appear in the detector at, as I said, twice the mass of the particle, approximately. So here I'm showing the strain on Earth as a function of frequency for a particle that's 8 times 10 to minus 13 eV. The vertical lines here show the expected frequency if you're emitting gravitational waves at twice the mass of the particle, or if you take into account the correction from the binding energy. So if you have a black hole with 20 solar masses, there's a negative binding energy that comes from that, and so the frequency is reduced, and it can be, it's also different based on the spin of the black hole because of the spin orbit coupling. So depending on if the spin of the black hole is larger or smaller, the binding energy also changes. The orange curves are showing the strain as a function of frequency for different assumptions in the black hole. If you have a black hole at a kiloparsec away, if you change its mass, the frequency, if you increase the mass, the frequency decreases because you have more binding energy, but also the strength of the signal increases because you have more overall energy in the cloud that comes from the black hole. So you can see these curves go up, and depending on the spin of the black hole for a higher or lower spin, there's the strain changes. If the black hole is older, by the time we look at the signal today, the cloud has partially annihilated away, so the signal is reduced. So that's the difference between the upper solid curves and the lower dashed curves, is the black hole was born 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 6 years ago. And these dots are now all of the black holes in our galaxy. So we have a simulated population of, say, 10 to the 8 black holes that were born over time with different spins and masses. And each of those can grow a cloud if it satisfies the superradiance condition. And that cloud will source gravitational waves that then we see at the detector today. So each of those is a monochromatic signal at a particular frequency and strain. Of course, the black holes are moving with respect to us, so there's also some Doppler smearing. Each of those dots is moved around by the velocity of the black hole. So you expect this kind of unique shape of strain versus frequency to appear in your detector. For reference, right now, the sensitivity of the detector at this frequency is about here. So you're kind of seeing the tip of this superradiance iceberg. And then the question is, how well can you do given the existing searches? So I've done an analysis with people who work with continuous wave data, which are exactly looking for these long monochromatic signals, which are very different from the big mergers that you guys have heard about from LIGO. So they look for pulsars, for example, if you have a rotating neutron star like the Vela pulsar, and it's not perfectly axisymmetric, it will emit gravitational waves at twice the frequency of its rotation. And the waveform of those gravitational waves is very similar to what you would look for from axion clouds around black holes. These are the current sensitivity limits from LIGO run 1, and there's also now results from run 2. So you can see the strains that you get are order a few times 10 to the minus 25. And we find that given these current results, you expect many signals to lie above the sensitivity, the upper limits of LIGO as it with data that's now on tape. So here are the number of signals that you would see in these searches if there was a particle of a mass that's shown on the x-axis. with different assumptions about the black hole population. So if you have black holes that have a power law mass distribution between, say, 5 and 20 solar masses, and a flat spin distribution between 0 and 1 when they're born, then you would see these signals here in gray dots. So if you believe the assumption about the mass and spin distributions, then you can use the fact that we haven't seen these signals to start placing bounds on the axion parameter space. Yeah.
You're not showing any blue points there.
Yes. Sorry, give me a second. Yes. So right now I'm just looking at this top one here, and then I'll show how this changes depending on the distribution. This is taking the current published LIGO limits from run one and run two. So this is, we have the signals, and then they're injected into the LIGO pipeline and get the number out. And so this is the, for example, in this bin, you look at the current sensitivity from, so now we're in run three. Continuous wave searches take a long time to wrap up because you need all of the data to get taken and then everything calibrated, and then you integrate for a long time. So there's no current results, as far as I know, on run three, but this is from runs one and two.
Do you see these sources?
Yeah, good. So these are all galactic sources. Depending on the mass of the axion, the distances range between 2 and 15 kiloparsecs. So, yeah, and so we have the black holes that are basically born in the disk and the bulge, and then they travel around the Milky Way, and then each of them sources a signal, and then we count how many are within the sensitivity.
So you have some model for like the number of
holes at these
Do you assume some sort of like pattern on the sky for their angular distribution?
Yeah, I mean, they're associated with particular parts of the Milky Way. So, I mean, the search doesn't care where it is. It's an all-sky search, but the actual distribution will mostly be localized in the galactic plane, I guess.
Are you sensitive to what you assume? Because you see the entire galaxy.
You see that you're not sensitive to what you assume. You see the entire galaxy. There are some slight differences. For example, if there's many signals in one frequency bin, it's easier to distinguish them if they're coming from different points of the sky rather than in the same point in the sky.
You place must depend on the template on the sky that you assume.
No, this is a blind search, so.
But if I add up all the different parts of the sky, like, and then place a Tiger bound, right?
This is not a stochastic search. This is looking, each individual signal appears separately, and you do an analysis basically saying each, so the black holes that we look at are, maybe I can show you a picture. Let's see. So the black holes that we're looking at, do I have it here? Maybe I don't have it, sorry. Okay, never mind, ignore that. But maybe this will help a little bit. So here is, say, the age and distance distribution of the black holes that are sourcing the signals. So that's what comes out in the end. And you can see there are some trends here. For example, you can see, of course, there's more distant black holes and more older black holes just by statistics. And so, but you can, it's easier to see a younger, farther black hole because those signals are louder because it was just born and the signal's still big. Anyway, what I really wanted to show is the distribution of black holes in the throughout the galaxy, but the way the search is done is you search over all points in the sky. So you're in the frame of the signal, you have a given frequency and a given frequency derivative. Here the frequency derivatives are very small, so you assume that it has zero frequency derivative. But then if it's, say, the black hole is over there, that looks like a different modulation in the solar system barycenter frame. And so you scan over all of those different possibilities with many, 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 many different frequencies, which is why these searches are extremely computationally intensive, the ones that are currently being done. So right now we've done them on the kind of faster, looser searches, but then there's these Einstein at home searches which take, I think, like 10 to the 7 CPU hours or something, which are distributed across many computers. And that looks for basically even finer binning across the sky.
What you're plotting is you've got a known population of black holes that's out there, or a hypothetical population that you're modeling?
It's a hypothetical population. If someone can tell me how many black holes there are in the Milky Way and what spin they have, then we would have a robust exclusion on axion parameter space.
If there's none, then there's no exclusion. Right?
If there's not, the exclusion is up to the uncertainties on the astrophysical population. So we know roughly, because we know what the rates are of, say, supernova that lead to black holes per Milky Way type galaxy. So we know approximately that there should be, say, between 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 8 black holes throughout the age of the galaxy. And then the much bigger uncertainty, as I will go back to the slide I was showing, is what the spin distribution of those black holes is. And so any statement has to be, there's a caveat that you have to assume what the spin distribution is. So here we're assuming a constant spin distribution. If you assume that there's no spins above 0.5, which is kind of a moderate number, then you still get up to hundreds of events. So if all of your black holes are born with fairly low spin between 0 and 0.5, you reduce the number of events by about a factor of 10. If there are no black holes with spin born above 0.3, then you really can't say much. There's only a few events above the current noise floor. Yes?
So, I mean, we do already see black holes in binaries with spins.
Yeah.
Measured to be, I guess, much higher than this. So, I mean, wouldn't they rule out these scenarios already?
Yeah, so exactly. So there are, so I've collected those spin bounds and talked to the people doing those measurements, and I've been able to set constraints on some parts of this parameter space, which are roughly, if you take those spin constraints at face value, they rule out masses about above here for axions. However, I do think it's very important to do these complementary searches, because there's a set of systematics that comes along with those measurements. And while I think, you know, we've thought about those systematics and we think they're quite robust, there's still some degeneracies in the measurements that you do that you can't guarantee 100% that those are. You always want to do more than one astrophysical search, basically.
So when they say they rule out, you said above something.
Yeah, above like 6 times 10 to minus 13.
Yeah, I didn't really see your pointer, Masha. Can you?
Oh, sorry. Is there a stick or something? Where's the hockey stick? Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So the region that I've placed constraints on is about above here.
Okay,
so that's if you take the current 5 most rapidly spinning black holes, which have spins of about 0.95, 0.99. Yeah, thank you. There's also dependence on the mass distribution. So there's a general modeling inference that if you have a high metallicity in the galaxy, you will have fewer very heavy black holes that are formed. And our galaxy has fairly high metallicity, so we're taking quite conservative numbers here. We're taking the maximum black hole mass to be either 20 or 30 solar masses. Of course, that's not true throughout the whole universe. We know there's heavier black holes that are merging in LIGO, but in the local galaxy, we don't really know what the upper bound is. So depending, I still need the stick. Given the current LIGO bucket sensitivity, you're actually not so sensitive to the mass cutoff. So you can see if you change the upper mass for the upper range of the black hole mass cutoff from 20 to 30 solar masses, you go to slightly lighter axion masses, and that's because the black hole gets bigger, so you're sensitive to particles that are lighter and have larger Compton wavelengths. But here you're starting to hit the low-frequency wall of LIGO at around 100 hertz, so it doesn't really benefit you to go to much higher black hole masses anyway. And so you can see that the main thing that you care about is the overall black hole number and also the black hole spin distribution. Those are the two big uncertainties here. Given a particular assumption, say if I believe this distribution here, you can use this to disfavor this range of axion masses. However, there's a hole in the middle here, and that's because one thing we found doing this analysis is that some of the signals are actually too dense. for the current searches as they're being done. So for example, if you have more than 10 signals in one frequency bin, they will interfere with one another and not from one step of the search to the next, they'll not behave in the way that you expect a signal to behave. And another problem is that if you have a lot of signals in one frequency bin, they would just look like noise to the algorithm, and it'll subtract out some of the signals. So right now, Maria Alessandra's group is looking at injecting these signals and verifying how well their searches are doing in this high density signal regime. Another thing you could do is look at stochastic search. And that's something I've also talked to LIGO experimentalists about pursuing.
So,
question?
The signals, though, are in principle separable, right? If you do the right thing.
Yes, exactly. So the signals are separable. It's just that right now we can't confidently say that we can exclude this range because the searches, the efficiency of the search hasn't been verified for that regime. But once you do it, then probably the efficiency won't be 100%, but it might be, I don't know, random number 20%. Sorry, continuous wave search people, I'm probably quoting the wrong number if you're listening on the internet. No, I'm just, but once you know what you're looking at, and that's exactly the point of what we did, is now there are kind of these scenarios of signals that you would plug into your search and see how well your search does, and we're putting all of this online, all of these signal injection sets, so anyone who wants to do a LIGO search can compare to the same benchmarks and compare across searches.
So do you expect this to change much going to O3 and beyond?
Yeah, you expect to see more and more signals. So as I showed in the beginning, there's many more weak signals. In particular, I think it's this one. So this shows a number of signals above a certain sensitivity threshold for different axion masses. So let's take a look at, say, 8. That's the one that I was plotting before. So that's this purple curve. So right now we're, I think, at 4 times 10 to minus 25. I might be getting the factor wrong. But then in run 3, you expect to change by, say, 50% or a factor of 2. Then you go up here. So you see, you would expect to see 3 or 4 times as many signals. And then when you go to, Cosmic Explorer or Voyager, or these futuristic gravitational wave observatories, then you see more and more signals. So one interesting thing would be you can look at, basically, as the searches progress, you can look at more and more conservative assumptions about the astrophysical population.
And is there a smoking gun to tell if you do see something, say it's not like a pulsar?
Yeah, there's 3 things you can do. One is you can, so because these searches integrate for very, very long time, you can actually localize the signal extremely well. And so you can go and look, like, is there a pulsar there? Okay, so that would be a way to know that it's not from this. So that's one. The second is a frequency derivative. As I mentioned, these searches right now are looking at 0 frequency derivatives, which is because the frequency is just set by the energy of the particle, and that doesn't change with time. With a caveat that there is a small change because there's a self-binding energy of the cloud with itself. And so as the cloud empties out by emitting gravitational wave radiation, the self-binding energy decreases, and there's actually a small positive frequency drift. Now, if you have a pulsar, you expect it to spin down, so you don't see that frequency. The frequency drift will always be negative. Of course, there's also motional frequency drift, so you can be sure that it's not coming from super radiance if the drift is large and negative, or if the drift is large and positive, then you think it was coming from super radiance, but in between there might be effects from the motion of the black hole relative to you. What we showed in this paper is that if you see one signal, is that you expect to see many signals with a very unique profile, like here, and we've looked at what it would appear like for different axion masses. So if you see one signal, you expect, you might get lucky and you might just be seeing the loudest black hole that's close to you, but in principle, you would expect a population of signals with a very particular strain versus frequency dependence, and that you could, that is not something you would expect for a pulsar. So that would be the smoking gun, in my opinion. Yeah. I guess I'm close to out of time. I want to give a quick advertisement of some ongoing work of Axion interactions. But before I move on to that, do you have any other questions about the gravitational wave signals?
I do have a quick one, which is, well, you mentioned a stochastic gravitational.
Yeah.
So are there bounds from that right now?
There is a paper, I believe it's by Palomba et al., but I might be confusing it with another paper. Anyway, I'll get you the reference. So there's a paper that looks for stochastic signals. However, they focus on signals from outside of the galaxy, and in my opinion, you would get a better constraint by looking at these stochastic signals from within the galaxy, because there's just more closer signals to us.
But there are many more things that are outside our galaxy.
There are many more things outside of the galaxy, but you can show that there's the power that's from our galaxy is also much, much closer than the nearest galaxy. So if you can see signals from our galaxy, it's usually better to look for those signals first. Now, they are less similar to the typical stochastic searches that LIGO does, because typical stochastic searches look for power at many different frequencies, whereas this one you really want to look for power in a small frequency bin, so you might have to change your search a bit. And I've talked to a couple of LIGO people about maybe changing their search strategy to look for this as well. Okay, how much time do I have? I don't know when I started, a few minutes?
Yeah, you start 3 minutes later, so I think you can go on.
Okay, let's do 3 minutes of self-interactions. Okay, so far I've focused entirely on the gravitational interactions of these particles, which I think is really incredible because we just from the fact that the particle exists in the Lagrangian, we don't assume anything about its population in the universe. It's just created from the black hole rotational energy. You can say something just from the fact that the mass gravitates and set constraints and look for signals in LIGO data. However, we do know that for axions, there are other interactions, like I talked about before. There's coupling to photons, there's self-interactions, and when you have so many axions in one place, those self-interactions can actually become important. So the takeaway point I want you to come away with is that in the presence of self-interactions, you can probe a complementary part of the axion parameter space. So early on, I talked about looking for heavy axions with photons. Then you can look for axions with gravitational waves and black hole spin down. As I mentioned, that's for when they're very weakly interacting, comparable with gravity. But there's also something you can do when the axions are light but more strongly coupled to one another. And so just to remind you of the gravitational picture, you have a black hole that forms, it spins down, you grow a number of axions in the cloud in the first level, and then it slowly annihilates away to gravitational wave radiation. That's what I just discussed. Then the next level can grow, that has a different amount of angular momentum, and that one will also slowly annihilate away to gravitational wave radiation, and the black hole will spin down in two steps. If you turn up the self-interaction between the axions, you can have a different source of energy loss, which comes from axion waves. So you can have two axions in level one make an axion in level two much faster than the black hole would produce those axions in level two. So here I'm comparing a high interaction scale around the Planck scale for axions in blue and a low self-interaction scale in orange. So in this case, if the interaction scale is low, which means the axions interact more strongly with one another, you'll populate multiple levels through the self-interaction, and actually you can take some axions from the cloud and emit axion waves off to infinity. If you combine more than one axion, you have some extra energy left over that gets emitted as non-relativistic axion waves. If the self-interactions are strong enough, then you get this equilibrium regime where instead of the cloud growing to full size, the cloud grows to some fractional size, but it stays there for a very long time, which has two effects. One is that the spin down is longer, so you relax the spin constraints, but also you have a very long period of axion emission. And the thing I'm very excited about is that this is a new mechanism with which you can create axions in the universe. So we know you can make axions from inflation, just assuming gravity and the inflationary story. Here, if you have axions that totally don't interact with us at all and never were produced in the early universe, the black hole just populates the galaxy with axion waves, just assuming that there's self-interactions. Now, if the axions do talk to the standard model, there are ways to look for them in the laboratory. In particular, there's experiments currently being designed to look for light axion dark matter, and they can be repurposed to look for these axion waves. Basically, you don't need to change the experiment, you just need to change the data analysis strategy similarly to how LIGO does this does a very complicated data analysis strategy for continuous gravitational waves. You'd have to do a similar search for continuous axion waves. And if you have, this is just showing, I'm happy to talk in more detail if you have questions. This is showing that current black holes, like the ones we know are rapidly spinning, could be sourcing these axion waves basically forever, slowly spinning down, populating the axion cloud, which then emits these axion waves that can then be detected that are close to the sensitivity threshold of some of these projected experiments. So I think that would be a really beautiful signal to be looking for, which is these axions that may or may not be dark matter, but still show up in your dark matter detector, just because there's a nearby rotating black hole that's pumping out these axion waves. Okay, so let me conclude. First, in this second part of my talk, I talked about how rotating black holes can teach us a lot about light axions. We're looking for signals of these axions in continuous wave searches at LIGO. And there's a lot of exciting future directions, like looking for axion waves from more strongly self-interacting axions in dark matter detection. And that can cover this whole range of parameter space, which would be, which may actually discover the axion. More broadly, I think right now we're in a place where we need creative new ideas to try to answer some of these outstanding questions in particle physics. And I told you about two of those. One is trying to see this invisible dark matter with light, and the other is looking for gravitational waves and axion waves from black holes. And I think there's still lots to do. So thank you very much, and I'll take some questions.
Are there other questions for Masha? For the dielectric stacks, is there any applications of that in other axion or dark photon detection regimes, like looking for axions or dark photons coming from the sun or anything like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So mostly the main use for them here is to correct the momentum mismatch between the dark photon, say, and the photon, which is less necessary when things are emitted from the sun because those are already quite relativistic. However, there are experiments like CAST, for example, which use something similar to this idea. So the CAST is telescope that's looking at the sun, but it blocks the sun. And so it looks for axions that are emitted in the sun and then convert inside the telescope. When the axions are on the heavy end, their reach decreases because exactly of this effect. And so sometimes they pump in some gas, which is similar to changing the dielectric constant to correct for that mismatch. And that lets them go to higher frequencies. So that sort of thing can be used there for other purposes. Do you have a question?
Yeah, the tail of your first part of the talk, when you were talking about bounds on dark photons, you said that it turns into a bound on axions and it was sensitive to QCD axion.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the last plots you had. I missed. So the thing that has to happen for the axion bound to happen, what's that waiting for and how long does that take?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would like to know that too. So the main thing that is difficult is the magnetic field. So the axions convert, so dark photons can just convert to photons directly if you with these layers. But for the axion, you need a background magnetic field to allow axion to photon conversion. Now, in principle, that's not hard. And I was just talking to one of the experimentalists at this workshop we were at recently that he's interested in starting to think about bringing in a magnetic field. You want a large magnetic field, so your sensitivity to coupling goes linearly as the size of the magnetic field you apply. So that's just expensive. So it's mostly money. The other issue that's more technical is that the detectors that they're using are superconducting and don't play well with magnetic fields, which is fine because our the photon detector is separated from the kind of photon producer. So you can put the photon producer in a magnetic field, and then you can take the photons and measure them somewhere else. That's just an extra step you have to implement. But you know, if there's funding, then I think it could be done in a couple years time scale, but you need a big expensive magnet probably. But you don't need a very large volume because these things are small, so I think it's quite doable. Yeah.
Are there competitors in that range that are a similar time frame?
Not as far as I know. So there's some plans for, there's two experiments that are light shining through walls that are being upgraded. And also, if IAXO ever happens, like the next cast, but those are kind of decades, and they might not go to the very heavy masses. So you can see, I can show you on the plot. Here. So, for example, cast here is falling off exactly because of this effect that I was saying in response to Joe's question. And then, so competitors would also be falling off here. And then currently the light shining through walls isn't even on this plot, it's more up here. So they really need to improve a lot. So I think we're in a good spot, but you never know with experiments. Yeah.
Any further questions? Then let's thank Rush again.